This is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, civilians fear Mideast violence could turn into full-scale war. Obama and Rasmussen meet as multiple crises face NATO. Both candidates declare early victory in a tight Indonesian presidential election. A new OECD report on middle health care.
We found that in countries, people with severe mental illnesses, so things like bipolar disorder or schizophrenia, die up to 20 years earlier than the general population.
And World Cup player behavior, real or fake, it's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. Violence in the Middle East is escalating at a time when there are no new peace talks in sight. Israeli and Palestinian leaders have condemned the brutal deaths of three Israeli teenagers and one Palestinian teen and have vowed to punish those responsible. But both sides also seem to be gearing up for more fighting. Israel has announced plans to deploy 40,000 reservists to its border with the Gaza Strip, whose Hamas leaders vow to fight Israeli occupation. Zlatiska Hoke reports that a desire for retribution on both sides currently prevails over calls for peace.
Israeli officials say they will use air and ground forces to put an end to daily rocket attacks from the Gaza Strip.
We will not tolerate rockets on our cities and villages, and therefore I ordered a significant enlargement of the Israeli Defense Forces operation against Hamas terrorists and against terrorists of the other terror organizations in the Gaza Strip. I did this only after all efforts that were carried out to return to calm were not answered, and Hamas chose an escalation.
Palestinians, for their part, accuse Israel of continued aggression. A spokesman for Hamas, the hardline group that controls the Gaza Strip, also expressed a determination to fight.
We will continue to defend our people against these crimes. We warn the occupation not to continue its crime against our people, and we assure that the resistance is ready to defend this aggression.
Residents on both sides of the Israel-Gaza border fear the conflict may escalate into a full-scale war.
Every time one side escalates, the other side does too. This has affected people's lives, especially since it's Ramadan and people are fasting. Life has become paralyzed because people are afraid. Now that we are in a war atmosphere, people stay at home and listen to the news. It's a difficult situation.
The Israeli government has urged citizens living near the border with Gaza to stay close to bomb shelters. Residents of Re'im ran to shelters when they heard bombing.
Tonight we had a very noisy night from in our side because the Palestinians sent so much rockets to the Israeli side. We had many problems with the citizens who were scared. We are out of shelters in the where we are living.
The United States has condemned the rocket attacks and called for de-escalation, but Washington has no influence in Gaza, especially after declaring Hamas a terrorist group.
Of course, the United States has a strong relationship with Israel, but the lack of relationship or influence on the other side is extremely limiting, and I think the influence that the United States could have to bring about sort of a ceasefire is not, you know, not very likely.
U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry has made reviving the Mideast peace process a top priority. He shuttled tirelessly between July of last year and April of this year to bring the sides together for talks. While some progress was made, Israeli and Palestinian leaders stumbled over some of the growing number of barriers that keep their people separated. The current outbreak of violence, the worst in the area since 2012, erupted soon after the last round of peace talks was declared dead. Zlatica Hoke, VOA News, Washington.
NATO Secretary General Anders Fogh Rasmussen has met with U.S. President Barack Obama to discuss the pressing crises facing the alliance in two different parts of the world. Tuesday's meeting at the White House came as NATO prepares for a critical summit in September. VOA's Jeff Selden reports from the Pentagon.
Smiles as President Obama met NATO Secretary General Anders Fogh Rasmussen in the Oval Office. But half a world away, in Afghanistan, their concerns were front and center. Four NATO soldiers killed Tuesday in a suicide bombing in eastern Parwan province, while allegations of fraud marred the result of the country's presidential election, with both candidates claiming victory, clouding NATO's future in the country.
If there is no clarification of this process before the NATO summit in September, then, of course, it's hard to see how the security agreements can be signed before the summit. And in that case, we would be faced with severe problems as regards planning for a training mission after 2014.
The U.S. has 31,000 troops in Afghanistan, with another 17,000 from the NATO-led International Security Assistance Force. But without that new security agreement, those levels could drop to almost nothing, opening the door for more instability. Then, there's pressure from Russia, which continues to occupy Crimea and back separatists in eastern Ukraine. Former U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine, Stephen Pfeiffer.
Given renewed concerns or new concerns about Russian policy and Russian behavior, you're going to see a renewed focus within NATO on the alliance's original purpose, which was to provide for the collective defense.
The U.S. and NATO have taken steps to reassure members like Poland and the Baltic states, who are worried Russia may try something similar against them. But there are differences over how far NATO and its partners should go. Swedish Foreign Minister Carl Bildt.
I don't think you can totally isolate a country like Russia, neither do we seek to do that. But we are sending very clear signals to Russia that their policies are unacceptable and it has an economic price.
Others say the U.S. and NATO have not been clear enough, like George Benitez at the Atlantic Council.
We're very much risk-averse here. And even though Putin is in a much weaker position, he's much more willing to incur cost and to pay the cost to enforce his position. And that's why his position is winning so far.
Another concern for NATO, a lack of support for defense spending. The Secretary General says if all members met their minimum requirement, the alliance would have had an extra $90 billion, critical at a time when NATO's facing threats on multiple fronts. Jeff Seldon, VOA News, The Pentagon.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's voanews.com. Online news for a changing world.
President Obama is urging the two candidates in Afghanistan's disputed presidential election to shun violent or extra-constitutional means or face a cutoff of U.S. assistance. VOA's Victor Beatty reports U.S. officials, while acknowledging serious fraud allegations, are calling for quick implementation of auditing measures to pave the way for a new, legitimate government and a post-NATO bilateral security agreement.
Mr. Obama, speaking with former Afghan Foreign Minister Abdullah Abdullah Monday and former Finance Minister Ashraf Ghani Tuesday, stressed the United States expects a thorough review of all reasonable allegations of fraud from the June 14 runoff vote. He called on all parties to avoid steps that undermine Afghanistan's national unity, saying there is no justification for resorting to violent or extra-constitutional means, and warning that would result in an end of U.S. assistance to Kabul. U.S. State Department spokeswoman Jennifer Psaki Tuesday said such a cutoff of aid is not considered a threat.
That statement was in response to the fact that there have been reports on the ground of plans to declare victory, to create a parallel government. Both of those steps would be illegal. And it's not a threat, it's a fact that certainly we wouldn't be able to provide the kind of support that it is our preference to provide if those type of steps were taken.
The special U.S. representative to Afghanistan and Pakistan, James Dobbins, says Afghanistan has made tremendous progress over the past 13 years and describes the idea of a parallel presidency as destructive. In an interview with VOA, the diplomat said the United States wants to see the stalemate between the two candidates resolved and political discussions between the parties to continue. He said Washington and its partners would not be able to support a divided Afghanistan at odds with itself.
Clearly, if either or both of these efforts fail, Afghanistan would be badly divided, and this would have a very deleterious effect on the prospects for peace and prosperity in that country and for the continued commitment of not just the United States, but the entire international community.
Preliminary results from the runoff election have Abdullah losing to Ashraf Ghani by some 1 million votes. But Abdullah Tuesday said he is the winner without any doubt and vowed to never accept what he called a fraudulent government. RAND Corporation South Asia analyst Jonah Blank says from Abdullah's perspective, this is not an unreasonable position to take.
He feels as if he lost the 2009 election due to fraud. And he feels that he bowed out in 2009 for the good of the country. In this case, he also feels that he is losing on the basis of fraud, and he is doing whatever he can to change the narrative to avoid, as he sees it, a victory for him being snatched away by fraud.
Jen Psaki says Afghanistan's Electoral Commission and the Complaints Commission need to examine all such allegations of fraud.
There are serious allegations. They need to be looked into. There needs to be a review of all the ballots that may or may not be legitimate. There are also some UN proposals that we think the electoral body should be working with them on. And at the same time, the candidates and their supporters need to be in conversations with each other about the formation of a government of national unity and a government that includes all of the relevant parties and important groups. And we feel both of those steps are important moving forward.
There are reports that Secretary of State John Kerry, currently in Beijing for a U.S.-China economic and strategic dialogue, may travel to Kabul on Friday. Dobbins said Kerry will want to meet with both candidates and try to work with them to see whether both the formal process of examining the ballots and determining the results of the election can go forward in a mutually agreed fashion. As for a bilateral security agreement yet to be signed by the U.S. and Afghanistan, NATO Secretary General Anders Fogh Rasmussen said Tuesday the BSA must be signed by September, or maintaining a force beyond 2014, when the NATO combat mission ends, will be problematic. White House spokesman Josh Earnest said the agreement is in the best interest of both American national security and the people of Afghanistan.
For them to sign this agreement, the election needs to be concluded. And because of the concerns that have been raised about fraud, the conclusion of that election is being drawn out a little bit. Fortunately, there is in place a series of procedures to adjudicate concerns about fraud. We have sought through diplomatic channels to encourage both sides to allow that process to work. And we're hopeful that both candidates and their supporters will continue to support that process as it moves forward.
Pentagon spokesman Rear Admiral John Kirby Tuesday said the electoral dispute is not affecting the U.S.-Afghan security relationship.
It's the first democratic transition of power in Afghanistan's history. It's historic on an epic scale. And yes, there's complications. We're certainly monitoring that and watching that and encouraging both candidates to let the process continue. It doesn't do anybody any good to threaten violence. We want to get a complete audit of the votes, the second round returns, before any kind of formal announcement is made one way or the other. We're not picking sides here. The only side that we're on is the side of the Afghan people, and I think we just need to keep focused on that. And there's absolutely no change in our commitment to the peaceful, stable future of Afghanistan.
Diplomat James Dobbins says while he would have preferred withholding the election's preliminary results until further audit measures were in place, he urges both candidates to quickly accept proposed UN auditing measures so the process can be completed in time for an August 2nd inauguration of Afghanistan's next president. He says what is crucial is a legitimate election result and a government that represents the major elements of Afghan society. Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
In Indonesia's closely contested presidential election, both candidates are declaring they have the mandate to lead, despite preliminary results showing a very close race. Kate Lamb reports on the day's events.
At polling stations across the capital Wednesday, Indonesian voters were equally divided on their pick for the next president. Supporters of Jakarta Governor Joko Widodo, or Jokowi as he is known, said they wanted to see a change in the old guard and admired Widodo for the tangible changes he has made in Jakarta. Widodo is especially popular among young Indonesians, 67 million of whom voted for the first time. The older generations tended to side with his opponent, former Army General Prabowo Subianto, arguing that Indonesia needs a strong and firm leader to hold the country together. after a nail-biting day in which exit polls swung widely in favour of one candidate or the other. Just hours after voting closed, Widodo declared that he had won.
Sampai saat ini menunjukkan bahwa...
Speaking at a conference, he told reporters that based on the results of a quick count, he and his running mate, Yusuf Kala, had won. The quick count, which is based on a sample of votes conducted by the reputable Center for Strategic and International Studies, or CSIS, put Widodo in front, with 52.74% of the vote against Prabowo, with 47.26%. But in a matter of an hour, Prabowo Subianto also gave a televised address, saying that he had also received a mandate to lead.
Memang menunggu sampai semua data masuk.
In the address, Prabowo thanked the Indonesian populace for trust and support and said that based on quick counts and surveys, he had been given a mandate to lead. The two quick counts that show Prabowo in front, conducted by Puskaptis and the Indonesia Voice Network, are seen as less credible than CSIS. On national television, the counts are also divided along partisan lines, depending on who owns each channel. Metro TV, owned by Jokowi supporter Surya Paloh, have showed scenes of Jokowi and his party celebrating. According to other channels, most of which back Prabowo, show he is the new president. Voters in both camps said they hoped the polls would go smoothly and peacefully, without any demonstrations or riots. Some 30,000 soldiers have been deployed across the country to maintain order. It's unclear whether the conflicting declarations will be swiftly resolved. The official result to be announced by the Election Commission will not be made until July 21st, more than 2 weeks away. Political analysts say the country will remain in political limbo until the General Election Commission announces the result. For VOA News, this is Kate Lamb in Jakarta.
Put your flags up in the sky. Hi, this is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports. Visit VOAfootball.com for live updates on the World Cup in Brazil. The site is optimized for your mobile phone or tablet and will bring you the latest scores, stats, photos, and videos. And everything can be shared with your friends from your mobile device to Facebook and Twitter. World Cup nonstop at VOAfootball.com.
The Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development is calling on governments to step up their efforts to improve mental health care. Emily Hewlett with OECD has authored a new report on the issue and spoke with us about her findings.
We looked at all the OECD countries, looked at mental health systems, and in mental health systems we found a strong trend of deinstitutionalization, so of countries looking to move care for mental illnesses away from inpatient hospital settings and into community settings. Broadly, that's seen as a positive trend. But what we also found, which was more negative and more problematic, was that there is still a significant burden of mental ill health, which is a burden for individuals, for societies, and for economies across OECD countries.
And it also means that people with severe mental disorder, they die earlier in life.
Yeah, that's true. We found that in countries, people with severe mental illnesses, so things like bipolar disorder or schizophrenia, die up to 20 years earlier than the general population.
And how widespread is the problem of mental disorders? We don't talk about it a lot.
Well, we think it's everywhere. We think that many individuals will be affected by mental ill health at some point in their life. OECD estimates have suggested that one in two people will experience mental ill health at some point across their life course. And we think that most people have a friend, a family member, or a colleague who's affected by mental ill health as well. So we think it's a really pressing issue for individuals, but also for societies and for economies, because mental ill health has significant consequences in terms of unemployment or reduced productivity at work, poverty, economic losses associated with lost productivity.
So what would you like governments around the world to do about this problem?
Well, we've identified three things which we think should be particular focus. We think that the first step is to improve measurement around mental health so that we can better understand the scale of the problem and really what works in tackling it. The second thing would be to increase provision of services, especially evidence-based services. We've suggested that expanding the role of the primary care sector with appropriate system-wide support is one way to do this. And we also think there's a need to really push for and secure better outcomes and high-quality care for all mental disorders, and that there are a range of different incentives that can be used to do this, like making sure that payment systems are driving the right incentives in mental health systems, and also that we have the good information that can tell us where services are delivering good outcomes and high-quality care and where there's room for improvement.
Emily Hewlett of the OECD's Health Division in Paris, France. Anyone watching football's World Cup is familiar with the head-knocking, pushing, elbowing, and even biting that can occur on the field, and that players on the receiving end of those maneuvers sometimes react in dramatic, seemingly exaggerated ways. VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with several sports psychologists about display behavior at football games and asked them about the strategic advantages of either hamming it up or playing it cool after these types of fouls during a match.
In a Brooklyn, New York bar overflowing with Brazilians watching their team compete in the World Cup, it's not only goals that get the crowd going. It's also when one of their players has been hit or tripped or pushed and rolls on the ground in apparent agony. Those fouls may prompt the referee to penalize the other team, either by handing out a yellow card or a red card, banishing the offending opponent from the game and the next, and or offering one's own team a free kick at the goal. But do those histrionics, real or faked, actually help teams to win? Dr. Daryl Rosenbaum, a sports physician at Wake Forest Baptist Medical Center in North Carolina, put that question to the test.
We basically sat down and watched a lot of soccer and looked for events where it looked like somebody was injured, when they went down to the ground, rolling around, holding a body part. We didn't have access to the medical records or anything, but we try and decide if it was a definite injury or not, if the player had to be subbed off within, you know, a few minutes, or if there was something really obvious like physical bleeding. We did find that 11 times a game in men's international soccer, somebody was apparently injured, and of those, only about 7% turned out to be true injuries. And we didn't find that the teams were any more successful that exhibited this type of behavior.
Still, feigning an injury can be a useful delaying tactic in a tough game, according to sports psychologist Harris Straitner of the Mount Sinai School of Medicine in New York.
Not to say you can't get hurt in soccer, but I think it's more of a strategy among European players that they may even be coached to milk the time, to buy their teammates time for a breather. It's like a boxer who may hug his opponent to buy some breathing time, or who goes down on a punch and waits just before the count of 10 to get up so that they can have some breathing time.
Straitner adds that players also use dramatic gestures to get a point across.
Psychologically speaking, if you are more demonstrative, you're going to get the referee's attention, and there's going to be a greater chance for you to have the opposing team receive a penalty.
In Straitner's opinion, Americans tend to underplay their injuries as compared to Europeans or Central or South Americans. He says American sports culture tends to value stoicism in the face of challenges, but that can work to the American team's disadvantage. First, playing when injured can make an injury worse. Second, making one's injury no big deal can mean fewer penalties for the other team. Yet Straitner acknowledges that there are cultures within American society where drama is encouraged.
I'll pick on my own culture. I'm Jewish, and my mother also had some Italian in her. And I will tell you that there was a lot of traumatics. That's not a bad thing. That's not a criticism. It's just how you're raised. If these teams are using that to their advantage, that's how they're being trained.
Questions of training, strategy, and display may be debated by fans during those non-game hours. But even experts put the finer points aside at this stage of the World Cup. Dr. Daryl Rosenbaum, an avid fan, says he welcomes the drama because he loves the game. And he says it's all part of the story. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington.
This is Today in History. On July 9, 1755, in North America, French and Indian forces defeated a larger contingent of British and American colonial troops near the French Fort Duquesne, where the city of Pittsburgh is located in western Pennsylvania. The French and Indian War battle was a setback to British efforts to expel the French from the Ohio Territory. But the reputation of British General Edward Braddock's young aide, 23-year-old George Washington, was enhanced by his command of the retreat after the general was mortally wounded. On this day in 1850, the 12th President of the United States, Zachary Taylor, died after just 16 months in office. Taylor, who never held prior political office, was elected based largely on his military victories in the War of 1812, the Mexican-American War, and conflicts with American Indians. In 1863, during the American Civil War, Confederate rebels defending Port Hudson in Louisiana surrendered to Union troops. This opened navigation on the Mississippi River to Union forces all the way to the mouth of the river in New Orleans. In 1868, the 14th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution was ratified by the states, granting citizenship to persons born or naturalized in the United States. It expanded civil and legal rights to all Americans, including newly freed black slaves. In 1943, during World War II, the Allied invasion of Sicily began. In 1993, British and Russian scientists announced they had positively identified the remains of Russia's last Tsar, Nicholas II, his wife, Tsarina Alexandra, and their three daughters. The remains had been excavated from a mass grave near Yekaterinburg in 1991. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States contributed an additional $8 million to the government of Pakistan to meet the food and nutritional needs of the internally displaced people from North Waziristan. The contribution provided through the United States Agency for International Development is part of the ongoing efforts of the U.S. government and the United Nations World Food Program under the Twinning Program. The Twinning Program is a partnership between the Government of Pakistan, WFP, and the international donor community through which wheat provided from Government of Pakistan stocks is transformed into fortified wheat flour and distributed in the most vulnerable communities. Donor funds are used to cover the costs of milling, fortification, storage, transport, and distribution of the wheat flour. This new commitment by the U.S. government will enable WFP to transform approximately 38,000 metric tons of wheat into fortified wheat flour, providing more nutritional food for the IDPs over a two-month period. Since the twinning program began in 2013, the government of Pakistan has provided 201,000 metric tons of wheat to the WFP for processing. With this contribution of $8 million, USAID has provided a total of $31 million in support, enough to fortify 60% of the wheat provided by the government of Pakistan. The United States has a long-standing history of and commitment to working together with Pakistan to provide humanitarian assistance and support human and social development. In 2014, USAID provided over $60 million in food assistance to Pakistan, in addition to the $8 million in support of the Twinning Program. Since 2009, the United States has provided over $1.4 billion in humanitarian assistance to Pakistan, making it the largest bilateral provider of humanitarian assistance. USAID Acting Mission Director Nancy Estes noted, "The United States' commitment to the Twinning Program is a demonstration of our support to the internally displaced population from the Fatah and the incredibly important partnership between the government of Pakistan, WFP, and the international community."
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.